Open your Bibles and turn on your brains. It's time for the Think Theism Podcast.
Can the existence of God be demonstrated?
I'm convinced that there are better arguments for theism than for atheism.
Meaning universe is not epistemically unlikely given theism.
Any contradiction between the existence of evil and God's being holy, good, and omniscient.
Now, if you study a well-made banana...
But that we evolved by a rather laborious... combination of random mutation.
One can't sensibly be both a naturalist and accept evolution.
The biggest difference, of course, winds up being who is Jesus and what role does he have?
Greetings. This, by the way, is a talk I'll be giving at Austin in a couple of weeks, and I'm hoping, with all the engineering background here, it isn't at too high a level. I'm hoping that if some of these things are obvious to you, that you'll go with me. But I want to talk about things AI will never do. We see the effects of materialism all over the world, the effect of how materialism sculpts people's worldviews and what they do. And this is happening in AI also. So you hear all of this dystopian sort of commentary about what's going to happen. That's what I want to address, and also how AI is turning into a church. So we all know about these different things coming up. Here is Honda's Asimo, named after, anybody know?
Asimov.
Yeah, Asimov, Isaac Asimov. 20 years ago, Garry Kasparov was beaten by Deep Blue. By the way, clearly a male, right? Blue? Okay, never mind. We had Watson beat people in Jeopardy, the world champions in Jeopardy. And then most recently, a mind-blowing thing, was the AlphaGo beating the world champion in the game of Go, which is the most difficult board game, most difficult popular board game, I should say, because maybe somebody could come up with even a more more difficult game than Go. But nevertheless, the fact that Go was mastered by artificial intelligence was a really, really big deal. As a result of that, we have developed the Frankenstein complex. I wish I'd have made that up, but this is also from Isaac Asimov in his I, Robot series. And the Frankenstein complex was what Asimov described as the fear of the mechanical man. And I think today we can probably generalize it to the fear of artificial intelligence. And everybody knows Mary Shelley and Frankenstein. How many have seen the movie? It's kind of boring these days, right? I don't understand how a guy that walks like this should be afraid of him. You know, it just takes mini steps. But that, but it was very, very interesting. And of course, we have all of this fiction talking about the different aspects of artificial intelligence. And of course, fiction is not constrained to be backed by fact. So sometimes there's a blurring there. As a result of that, today people have taken AI, and we have all sorts of just terrible headlines about it that scare the bejeebers out of you. Neurosciences translate brainwaves into recognizable speech. Yeah, what they don't tell you is you got to cut a flap out of your brain and put sensors right on your brain, and the neural network they train is only good for your thoughts, and they just show you about three different pictures. They don't tell you that in the picture. It's totally extrapolated out of bounds. End of life as we know it. We know that AI is going to take over all the jobs in the world. Protecting humanity in the face of artificial intelligence. Yep, it's going to take over. How we can prepare for the catastrophically dangerous AI and why we can't wait. Now, there are going to be dangers in AI, there's dangers in all new technology. And we can address that. The truth about killer robots, the year's most terrifying documentary. The AI Cold War that threatens us all. And this last one I'll refer to, Army researchers are developing a self-aware squid-like robot you can 3D print in the field. Notice, self-aware, just like you and me. They're self-aware. Yeah, whatever that means. So we also have people affected by the Frankenstein complex, and these are people that are very knowledgeable and very smart. Bill Gates, for example, said, "I don't understand why some people are not concerned about artificial intelligence." And there's lots of things to be concerned about. but I think we need to look at it with jaundiced eyes. The late Stephen Hawking says, talk about scary. The development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. It would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans who are limited by slow biological evolution couldn't compete and would be superseded. This is Stephen Hawking's. It turns out what he said, he's a brilliant guy, but just because somebody is brilliant in one field doesn't mean they're brilliant in another one. A brilliant physicist is not a brilliant computer scientist. I have no idea why we have people that are movie stars testifying in front of Congress about foreign affairs. They have no idea about foreign affairs, but they're famous in one area, so therefore they must be smart everywhere. Hawking's was indeed not the case. And then we have Elon Musk. With artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon. George Gilder, who some of you might know from his work in business, had a great comment. He says, Elon Musk is a great entrepreneur, but a really retarded thinker. And he comments on things that he doesn't know about. And we'll talk about this in a little bit. Now, why all of the junk AI news? One is fake news clickbait. People want to grab you with headlines in order to get you to click, in order to visit more advertisers to get more money. We have untutored journalists, people that think they know what artificial intelligence is when they don't. We have research promotion. We talked about this in terms of professors. This is a very real problem in academia. And I can go out in the field and go out to the media and say, I have the best research in the world, and begin to promote it, maybe not telling the whole truth, or maybe in such a fashion where the journalist would take it and report it in some hyperbolic sense. I see a lot of that. And of course, there's always the conspiracy nuts. What are the tools that they use? Number one is seductive semantics. Remember that squid said it was self-aware? That's a pretty sloppy use of the word self-aware. What does self-aware mean? Well, if you look it up in the dictionary, it means aware of your environment. Well, in that case, my car is aware of my environment. When I'm backing up, it goes beep, beep, beep if I get too close to something. Is my car self-aware? I don't think so. But I think in the most sloppy application, you could actually talk about it being self-aware.
Yeah, it dings when it's freezing, too. Okay. All kinds of sensors on this thing.
That's right. Yep, that's right. So it's conscious. It's self-aware. It's your self-aware. Car is self-aware. Consciousness. I'm pretty sure that I'm conscious. I'm not sure about any of you. Okay? I'm pretty sure that I'm conscious. How do I know I'm not in the matrix? You know, consciousness is another one of these words that is thrown about and used extensively without actually defining it. Seductive optics, we see robots all the time, and the underlying AI is enhanced by the use of these robots. The actual AI has very little to do with its packaging, but we package it in a manner to resonate with what we're thinking is human, and that's a problem. And then, as I mentioned about cutting out the brain flap for reading memory, there's hidden details. Now, there is an AI church which is developing. If you're a materialist and you believe that the world is only material and always has a naturalistic explanation, you will develop your own gods, because there's something here happening that you have to explain. We all know the worshiping of the golden calf when Moses left the Hebrews alone, right? They said, we can't stand it. We need some sort of a god. There's talk today about uploading your brain into a computer. Why? So you can live forever. Christians have had that beat for thousands of years.
Right.
We know we're going to live forever. We've already addressed immortality. But
it's
the
a
AI,
lot cheaper, too.
it's a lot cheaper. And we'll find out that it is not something you can do. You cannot upload yourself. So therefore, Christians are up. One of the things the computers would like to do is they would like to develop programs that write better programs, that write better programs, eventually writing a program that is super intelligent. This will never happen, by the way. But we in the Judeo-Christian ethic, Judeo-Christian ideology have had super intelligence all the while. It's a characteristic of our God. He's omnipresent, all the omnis. Yeah. They have the Bible. How many have heard of Ray Kurzweil? he's kind of this guru that goes around and has all this dystopian values about what's going to happen. All the jobs are going to be gone. We're going to be the pets of AI sometime in the future. Exactly. Well, they're going to be so superior to us that, you know, that that's going to be the case. They have the prophets, dystopian Yuval Harari, an Israeli. He writes all of this depressing view about the future, about how AI is going to totally take over our jobs. And I don't think so. We also have the AI church has their apostle Paul. This is true. This sounds wacky, but it's true. There was this, he's called a wunderkind, a guy in Silicon Valley that was really big in the development of self-driving cars. He founded the AI church, the way of the future. And of course, in order to have the AI church, what you need is you need a tax exemption. So in order to get the tax exemption, Lewandowski wrote the IRS with an epistle. Okay, and his epistle actually was kind of the equivalent of the Apostles' Creed of the AI Church. It says, the AI Church believes in the realization, acceptance, and worship of a Godhead based on artificial intelligence developed through computer hardware and software. Isn't that chilling? So therefore, there are people who are so steeped in materialism, they can't believe in the true God, so they actually have to make up one, just like the golden calf. And this is a characteristic that we have of the AI church. Now, I don't think the Bible refers specifically to AI, but we are told in Genesis 1:26 that we have control and we have dominion over all of the animals of the earth. Does that include AI? I don't know. But in one of the Psalms, it says, thou madest man to have dominion over the works of his hands, thy hands, God's hands, I guess. Thou hast put all things under his feet. So AI is always going to be under our feet. And if AI does something bad, it's probably our fault, as we'll talk about. So when you get back to ideas and you begin to get into arguments, it's usually good to go back to fundamentals. I mean, what do the football players do when they lose a game? The coach says, let's get back, let's practice the fundamentals in order to get things well. So in order to understand AI, we have to go back to fundamentals. I love this quote by Eleazar Yudkowsky. He said, by far the greatest danger of artificial intelligence is that people conclude too early that they understand it. And we have a lot of people writing about artificial intelligence, claiming that they understand it, but they really don't. And in order to understand it, they need to get back to the fundamentals. So here is a place where I hope you follow me, and many of you probably know this. Computers are restricted to performing algorithms. Many people, not engineers, hear algorithms and they go, what is an algorithm? Well, it's nothing more than a recipe. It's a set of rules to be followed in problem-solving operations, a step-by-step procedures. If you shampoo your hair, you have an algorithm there. It says, wet your hair, apply shampoo, lather, rinse, repeat. Does anybody know the problem with this set of instructions?
That's right.
It's repetitive. You're going to be washing your hair forever if you're a computer. Right? Because it doesn't say repeat once, it says repeat. And so you're in a for loop.
And there's no need to.
And there's no need to, but... that's right. Follically challenged, right? Okay, so that's an example of a recipe. When you're baking a vanilla cake, you first of all have the recipe for it. You have the input into the program. That's all the ingredients that you have. Once you develop have the input to the algorithm, you actually begin to follow the step-by-step procedure for baking the cake. This is an example of an algorithm. It's a step-by-step procedure for doing something. And this is what computers do. They follow algorithms. If you look at Google Maps, like I did this morning in getting here, they give you a step-by-step procedure, directions on how to get here. This is an algorithm. This is something that computers can do. Anybody know what the joke is here?
It's an algorithm.
Yeah. I had to throw this in. Anybody, you know who this is, right? That was Bill Clinton's vice president. Al Gore, yeah, so know your homonyms, algorithm is not equal to algorithm. Okay, so that's the only joke I have. Didn't go over very well, but if you're learning the programming language of C, probably the first program algorithm that you learn is a little program called Hello World. You go boom, 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 you hit the return button, and the computer says, Hello World, almost like it's talking to you. And so this, again, is the first thing that you learn. But everything that you see on a computer, everything a computer does is an algorithm. Here is a screenshot of the web page for the Walter Bradley Center. By the way, advertisements, mindmatters.ai. Notice .ai. That's kind of cool, right? It's not .com, .org, .anything else. It's .ai. Well, you look at this, and, you know, it looks very nice, but there's a place you can actually click on the Chrome web browser, and what you do is you get the computer code that's being followed to generate this website. So, therefore, you get an algorithm which actually tells you what this web page is doing. So algorithms, even on your web browsers, control what you do. And of course, the way that it happens is that you have an algorithm, a set of code, which is written by the computer programmer. It's put into a compiler, and it generates machine code. And this machine code is a bunch of ones and zeros. And that's the language that the computer understands as it begins to flip around. And this is, again, what is controlling the computer. Of course, we have our own computer code. We have DNA. DNA is in fact a great computer code. By the way, I need to know timing. So could you give me a 10-minute warning or something?
Okay, you're fine.
Okay, so far so good. Okay, so there are four nucleotides in DNA, A, C, G, and T. And each one of these is 2 bits. We can assign an A equal to 00, C is equal to 01, G is equal to 10, and T is equal to 11. And then any string of binary numbers at all, you can actually represent as ACGTs. So here we have a 01, that's a C. Here we have a 00, which is an A. So we see that we have actually a computer code in our DNA. The question is, does it program a computer? Does it program the new life? Or is there something above and beyond what it programs? One of the things engineers do, and one of the things I've been doing for a number of years, is actually looking at this is a biological neuron. This neuron has a bunch of components. It comes out here and it connects to a bunch of other neurons. So neurons are connected to neurons that are connected to other neurons, and they fire and they communicate. This graphic is probably incorrect because it's showing it on the surface. But nevertheless, we have all of this communication. There is a big area of artificial neural networks. In fact, you hear about it today. Artificial neural networks, deep learning, deep convolutional neural networks, a number of different areas. And what the engineer, pitching my book here. This is, what do they call it, paid placement?
Yeah,
except
product,
product placement, so product placement here. So the engineers have modeled a neuron as a computational entity where a number of inputs are weighted, subjected to a sum, and run through a nonlinearity. And each one of these little dots over here corresponds to one of these. And you connect them all together. And then what you want to do is you want to expose it to learning. Say, for example, I wanted to learn the difference between a pig, a cow, a horse, and a chicken. I would present the neural network with cows and pigs and chickens. I probably should actually use the value that's here. They're actually trying to figure out how to recognize handwritten characters here. 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So what you do is you put in a number, and then you put it through, and then you get something, but that ain't probably good, at least the first few times. So what you have to do is you have to correct all of the weights so that the next time you see it, it can recognize it better. And then you repeat with different values, and you keep going back and forth until this neural network, when presented a handwritten character, will respond with the proper classification. Basically, what is happening here is all of these weights, these lines, they have to be adapted. You have to assign a number to each one of them in order to get the proper operation. And that's called training the artificial neural network. And that's like turning a bunch of knobs. You have to actually choose the knobs. Each one of these weights is a knob, and you have to choose the knob in order to get the input-output relationship. Yeah.
Is this similar to like a quantitative structure-property relationship? This is what we do in chemistry for pharmaceuticals.
Okay, I'm not familiar with that. I'm not familiar with that.
It sounds very similar.
Okay.
This is an area I don't know much about, so I'm curious.
Okay. So this is an artificial neural network. We can talk about that later because I'm not sure. I know what that is, but it is. It's an adaptation. When I first got started, it used to take days in order for us to tune these neural networks to do what we wanted it to do. Today, you can do it in a flash, and that's what's made artificial intelligence really, really good, as well as a proposition of a couple of new really cool algorithms. Now, we know about algorithms. In our thought, we think everything is an algorithm. In fact, I think the materialists think everything is an algorithm. If indeed we can have a human create a machine which is human itself, then that has to be done algorithmically if it's used with computers. But are there things which are not algorithmic? Are there things which you can't write a computer program? Alan Turing, how many have heard of Alan Turing? Okay. Anybody seen the movie The Imitation Game? Okay, with Benedict Cumberbatch, I think, as Alan Turing's thing. Well, Alan Turing is the father of computer science, and he did a lot more than break Enigma. He was able to actually show that you could not do the following. Give me any computer program. Now, this computer program, it will run forever, or it will stop after it runs for a while, right? The shampoo, that runs forever, right? And if we put repeat once, it would halt. So the question is, can you take any computer program and write another computer program to analyze it to say whether that computer program halted or ran forever? This is something which is introduced to beginning computer science people. So this is called the Turing halting oracle. You put this program in there to the Turing halting oracle, and the Turing halting oracle would say that it would halt and run forever. And Alan Turing showed back in the 1930s that writing an algorithm to do this was impossible. The Turing halting problem is non-algorithmic. And in fact, we're so used to thinking in algorithms that there's probably most of the things around us that are non-algorithmic. Some of them also in computer science, Rice's theorem, Kolmogorov complexity, and this is really cool, the unknowable. We can actually show in computer science that there exist things. We can actually prove these things exist, but we can also prove that they're unknowable. What about some non-computing human attributes? Here are some possibilities that will never be simulated by a computer. Qualia, understanding, emotion, creativity, sentience, and consciousness. If you're like me a year ago, you don't know what qualia means, right? Let me tell you what qualia means, and one of the reasons that it's non-algorithmic. Imagine you take a red delicious apple. You anticipate the bite. You take the bite. You feel the crispness of the apple. You feel the tart sweetness of the meat inside. You begin to chew and you swallow. That is an experience. It's an individual instance of a subjective consciousness experience. Could you write computer code to tell a computer what you just experienced? It's non-algorithmic. Same thing with hot buttered sweet corn. A little bit of salt, okay? And headaches and deep paper cuts is also an experience that you could not write a computer program to communicate to a computer that experience. These are non-algorithmic things. John Searle in 1980 showed why computers can never understand things. Qualia, we're going through the list. The second one is understanding. Here's the idea. Do computers understand what they do? The computer can add the numbers 8 and 2, but the computer doesn't know what the number 8 means. It doesn't know what the number 2 means. You know what? I have to go over here for a second. And Searle explained in general why this isn't the case. Imagine a room, and you're in this room, And Searle actually put himself in there. And what happens in this room, there's a person that's isolated in this room. And what you do is you go over and you slip a paper, piece of paper in Chinese into the little slot. The person looks at the piece of paper and goes, okay, they have a big file cabinet. Do you guys know what a file cabinet is? Okay. They go over and they begin to look through the file cabinet and they look and they say, oh, finally, here is that same thing. Oh, here's the translation. And it could be in English, it could be in Portuguese, it could be in a language they don't understand. So the person writes down, the person in the room, in this Chinese room, writes down the translation, slips it through the door, and the guy on the other end takes it and looks at it and says, wow, this is really, this person knows Chinese and Portuguese. No, the computer didn't know Chinese and Portuguese. They just did a lookup table. They couldn't read Chinese and Portuguese. In fact, if you're familiar with Jeopardy, that's exactly what happened there. They would ask them a question or ask them an answer. You know how Jeopardy goes. And then there would be a response. The computer, Watson, was actually a big Chinese room, except he didn't have a bunch of file cabinets. He had access to all of Wikipedia.
Yeah, Wikipedia.
Yeah, exactly. And so it was a big Chinese room. Did Watson understand what it was doing? No. It had no understanding of what it was doing.
Did it celebrate when it won?
Well, in fact, that's one of the quotes that I have.
Oh, okay.
That's right. In fact, boy, anticipate. This is Deep Blue, who is a guy, Garry Kasparov. Now, if you know that Deep Blue is a male, what's his girlfriend's name? Deep Pink, right?
You might want to give a bit of context for those who don't know. Kasparov was a world champion chess player.
Yes. Beat him, yep. 20 years ago. He was not just an average Joe off the street. He was the world champion. Thank you, Glenn. So here's a guy named David Glentner. He's a computer scientist at Yale University. And he wrote, the idea that Deep Blue has a mind is absurd. How can an object that wants nothing, fears nothing, enjoys nothing, needs nothing, and cares about nothing have a mind? It could win at chess, but not because it wants to. It isn't happy when it wins or sad when it loses. Is it hoping to take Deep Pink out for a night on the town? It doesn't care about chess or anything else. It plays the game for the same reason a calculator adds or a toaster toasts. It's because it was a machine designed for that purpose. And in the AI world, we have to remember that. Again, this is all fundamentals. Now, here's a question. How can we test whether a machine has reached an intelligence? Alan Turing proposed something called the Turing test in the late 30s. And he said, he proposed, are there imaginable digital computers which would do well in the imitation game? Do you recognize that name? That was the name of Alan Turing's film biography, where Benedict Cumberbatch played Alan Turing, the imitation game. Can a computer imitate a person? And so he asked this question. So the Turing test was basically you sit on one side of a curtain and you converse usually on a keyboard, because back then the computers couldn't talk. You converse on a keyboard with somebody and you can't tell whether the person responding to you is a human or a machine. That was the Turing test. Now, unfortunately, the Turing test sounded good in Turing's days, but today Selmer Bringsjord, who I have a lot of respect for, he said, during Turing's dream is coming only on the strength of clever but shallow trickery versions of the Turing test. There was a few years ago, Eugene Goostman went all over the news as this computer program that had passed the Turing test. But was it trickery? Fundamentally, yes. He was a 13-year-old Ukrainian AI boy. And why was he 13 years old? Well, 13-year-olds don't know everything, right? So therefore, if he didn't answer questions, you could say, ah, man, it's a young kid. Mm-hmm. Plus, Ukrainians are going to have English as a second language. So, you know, if his English wasn't perfect, that's okay, too. You understand it. So that's a simple way that it was gamed. Now, today we have something called chatbots. Anybody used a chatbot in here? Okay, yeah, they're really fun. But can you tell that they're AI after a while? Yeah, you can tell if they're AI. So, therefore, we get to this point of, well, another point that is non-algorithmic, which is creativity. I maintain, and I think others do too, that the computer can never be creative. And we're going to talk about that. Yeah, Luke?
Well, I just have a question about the Turing test. Was it, like, I can understand somebody being fooled in, like, a conversation, but imagine trying to, like, fool somebody over a year of, like, life or something. Mm-hmm. Is that, like, how long do you take the Turing test out? Because I feel like I could totally be fooled by a chatbot, but, like, I knew somebody for, like, a month, and it's like, this is not a real person, obviously. Like, mm-hmm. you know what I mean?
I just wrote a column for Mind Matters on this, on an assertion that the sex robots today would come out and replace marriage. That was a claim. And my response was, is that people that actually fall in love with robots don't know the difference between love and being horny. Mm-hmm. There's two different sections there. And then I said, loving somebody is very, very different. The relationships is a part of it, but it's very much different. And I said, you can ask me, somebody that's been happily married for 43 years to the love of their life. No, she never surprises me. She's not a computer. Always good stuff. So, Luke, you're right. I think that you spend any time with these things and you're going to see that they are limited. When they begin to answer your questions with questions, which is a good runaround, you can see that indeed this happens. Now, this was recognized, and we're going to talk about this. You've heard of computers writing music, computers doing art and being sold at Sotheby's, and all of these other things. And so we're going to address that. I just read an article about a philosopher that says, gosh, AI is not doing things that humans can do. We have just taken our ideal for creativity, and we've lowered it in order to say that it's the same. But this was a quote by Patrick Wall of MIT. He's saying, do these machines produce anything really new? When you consider the great new ideas produced by men like Newton and Darwin and Galileo, you'll find initially they had to throw away the old rules that they grew up with. Now, machines do what they've been told to do. They obey the rules that have been fed into them by man, and we know of no machines at present that have the means of overcoming this limitation. Now, Wall said this in 1961, and it's still true today. The basic idea is that machines are incapable of thinking outside the box. You've heard of that term. Machines, when presented data, for example, say in composing music, here's a typical scenario. You take a machine and you train it with works of Wagner. And then you turn it on and says, create. Guess what it will create? It'll create something that sounds like Wagner, right? It's just an interpolation. You get this box of information and the computer's still in that box trying to figure out things. Never will it present works of somebody like, one of my favorites is Schnittke and Charles Ives. I like some of this weird modern music. You will never get Bach out of it because it is creative and the machine doesn't have the ability to be creative. It can only take what it's looked at and interpolate. It can extrapolate. It can't go outside the box of what it's done. That was what Wall was referring to. Creativity I first stumbled on was this genius guy here, Roger Penrose, an atheist, but nevertheless a very honest one. And he actually wrote a couple of books which actually purported that humans were creative above and beyond the capabilities of any machines. And he said that one of the keys of this was a flash of genius, that we have flashes of genius outside the box. And this is a characteristic of creative people. And I bet you've had them. You've been thinking about something and boom, something comes in. You haven't been thinking about it. You never thought about it before. It's not your background, but you go, wow, that's a cool idea. Let me give you some examples. How many have heard of Gauss? All the mathematicians and engineers have. Gaussian probability density function. Gauss's law is one of Maxwell's equations. A great mathematician. In fact, he made it on the stamp, I think, of some German things. He said, Finally, 2 days ago, I succeeded not on account of my hard efforts, but by the grace of the Lord, like a sudden flash of lightning, the riddle was solved. I am unable to say what was the concluding conducting thread that connected what I previously knew with what made my success possible. So in other words, he had this flash of genius outside the box. And we see this continually in creative things. Nikola Tesla invented the brushless motor. He said, this is interesting because he uses the same wording that Gauss did, probably not knowing about Gauss's comment. He uses the word flash of lightning. He said, the idea came like a flash of lightning, and in an instant the truth was revealed. I drew with a stick in the stand the diagram shown 6 years later in my address before the American Institute of Electrical Engineers, which now is the IEEE, and my companion understood them perfectly. So again, a flash of genius. This is outside of the box. It also occurs in the arts. Let's see if I can do this. You're going to have to listen real carefully here.
I used to live in this little flat up at the top of a house, in a little room I had, and I had a piano by the bed. And I just woke up one morning with this tune in my head. And I thought, I don't know this tune, or do I? It's like an old jazz tune or something, and because my dad used to know a lot of old jazz stuff. But maybe I've just remembered it or somewhere. So I sort of went to the piano, found the chords to it. You know, it was like in G, F sharp minor, 7, sort of B and that. And just remembered it, made sure I remembered it. And then I just hawked it around all my friends and stuff and said, what's this? You know, it's got to be something. It's like a good little tune, you know, and I couldn't have written it because I just dreamed it, you know. You don't get that lucky.
So therefore, creativity also comes in the arts. Just a flash of genius. Okay, don't want to do that. So therefore, for Paul McCartney, the tune for Yesterday was a flash of genius. And we see this in the arts, we see it in the sciences. Here are some other people. Anybody recognize him?
Yeah.
Tom Petty. He wrote some kind of cool songs. They only had 4 chords, but they were pretty good nevertheless. My songs just fall out of the sky. I hesitate to even understand it for fear it might make it go away. It's a spiritual thing, he said. And then this one, Robert Shellman, this summarizes it very nice. He says, to compose, all you need to remember is a tune nobody else has thought of before. So this is all the flash of genius. It does turn out in the early 20th century that in order to get a patent in the United States, your patent had to demonstrate a flash of genius. That was a requirement for a patent. Now you can patent one click for Amazon. So it's pretty bad. So therefore, that's an aspect of creativity. The Turing test doesn't test creativity. It tests imitation. There was a great computer program, Ada Lovelace. They have a computer program named after her called Ada. She was the first computer program in the 18th century when a guy named Charles Babbage came up with a mechanical computer, which was way before his time. And she was one of the first computer programmers, historically. She says computers can't create anything, for creation requires minimally originating something. But computers originate nothing, they merely do that which we order them via progress to do. So again, computers cannot be creative. For this reason, Selmer Bringsjord substituted for the Turing test something called the Lovelace test for creativity. The Lovelace test is strong AI. Strong AI is human duplicating AI. Will be demonstrated when a machine's creativity is beyond the explanation of the creator. Now, in AlphaGo, they say that AlphaGo made this incredible move that nobody anticipated. Well, what was AlphaGo programmed to do? It was programmed to play Go. Now, if AlphaGo went on and learned by itself without any additional input from programmers to play checkers or chess or came up with a brand new game, that would be creative. That would have passed the Lovelace test. But when things do what they're meant to do, that is not creativity. Nobody has passed the Lovelace test. One of the one of the things that people are talking about now is superintelligent. We saw Stephen Hawking talk about this. Computer programs that would generate other computer programs that would generate other computer programs, each being smarter. If that was the case, two or three generations down, the program that was generated by the original programmer would be outside the explanation or the understanding of the computer program. So superintelligence would be a proof of the Lovelace test, and it will never happen. You only get out of a computer what you put into it. So nobody has passed the Lovelace test.
Prediction it's in this millennium, though. Did you see the two?
What's that?
It's a prediction that it's in this millennium.
Oh, I guess it is. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, this was done by a very optimistic materialist.
That's right.
That's what it was done. Now, we talked about music being created by feeding a computer a bunch of works by Wagner and then spitting out something that sounded like Wagner. Let's talk about pictures, because this was big, because I think there was a computer-generated artwork that was sold for $500,000 at Sotheby's. Okay. Now, everybody knows, we have Walter Bradley Center of Natural and Artificial Intelligence. We know that natural intelligence can play around with Photoshop and do some interesting things. And this is an example of me playing around with Photoshop. Okay. It was supposed to get a bigger laugh than that. Okay.
Yes.
That's me with my grandkids. Yeah, that's a granddad. And I took this picture and duplicated it down here and over here, right, about the author. So
that's great.
Yeah. Okay. So basically we have computer programs now that will go ahead and they will generate art, which you can sell at Sotheby's. But you know what? If you feed a computer program a bunch of work by Picasso, guess what it will generate? Something that looks like Picasso. There's a great thing. If you haven't read about it, you can go to deepdreamgenerator.com and you can make your own kind of modern art. This is actually a picture of my great-grandparents from West Virginia. Notice they had their Bibles and their Frankenstein shoes. And if you run it through Deep Dream Generator, you get out stuff like this. Now, that's that's weird, okay?
Yes,
now, what happens, this computer program was actually trained on animals and reptiles and different things, so what can it generate? It can generate animals and reptiles and different things. So you notice that some way we got these pigs, I don't know what they are, that grew out of here. My grandmother is covered in a helmet with a little antenna up here. But go to deepdreamsgenerator.com and you can put in your own pictures and you can make these really arty things, which unfortunately won't sell at Sotheby's because the program's readily available. And here is me, my fetching wife, my son and my grandson, and this is what we did. Apparently, over here, I look bird-like because I developed into a bird at this point, okay? So therefore, yeah, this is what the computer program does. But more significantly, we had, this is the painting that actually sold at Sotheby's for $432,500 in an auction. And this is not the whole picture, this is the whole picture. And it sold, and it was generated by AI. Really, really exciting. Like a lot of things reported in AI, since I'm an old guy, I said, when I was a boy, we did this. And we did this when I was a boy. I'm going to show you what we did. This was actually back in 1991. We took a whole bunch of people's pictures, and then my co-author, Dennis Saar, said, wow, wonder what would happen if we take all these pictures, trained a neural network, and gave it my daughter's top of the head here, and this one the bottom of the head, wonder what would happen. Well, it actually grew this picture. These are a bunch of iterations, and it grew this picture. So this is computer-generated art. More recently, in my book, Handbook of Fourier Analysis and Its Applications, we took the training of a number of great scientists and mathematicians, and this is the library that we used. Have you ever wondered what the average mathematician looks like? That's the average of all of these pictures. Yeah. So that's what the average mathematician looks like. What's that?
Didn't pick the best looking one.
Yeah. Well, we did. So the question was, I have an ego. So I wonder what happened if I took one of my pictures and I seeded the program with this, what face would it grow?
Interesting.
Okay. In other words, looking at all those other libraries. So it generated this and then this. I don't know. That's worth selling, right? What do you think?
Shroud of Turin.
Yeah, it's a Shroud of Turin. Oh, that's right. That's great. I'm going to call this the Shroud of Bob. Okay. Yeah, the Shroud of Bob. So again, this is old stuff. It generates roughly what you trained it to do. It's not a big deal. So I put the original face, my face, and I'm going to ask you to judge as artistes which one is better. Yeah.
Why don't you make $400,000?
I don't know. Probably because I published the paper and told him how I did it. So, now all of this, I don't want to come in here and just bang AI and stuff. It is overreported. It does have a lot of hyperbole with it. We are going to have a lot of problems. I'm actually working now on a position paper of AI in the military. And when should AI in the military be totally autonomous? It's a very dangerous sort of thing to consider. Right? Will AI self-driving cars displace truck drivers? I mean, these are serious sort of situations. But you read different people. If you read people like George Gilder and Jay Richards and John Toomey, you'll find out that they have a very positive view of the future in AI, that AI is going to allow us to all pursue our dreams and get paid for it a lot better than has been done in the past. Why? Because things are freed up. We don't have to worry ourselves about mundane things.
Can we start at least with self-driving things on rails, like the trains?
Well, it's I go to
reduce
the
degrees of freedom a little bit.
I go to the Dallas airport and I ride on a self-driving train on tracks. Exactly. So we've had that for years. Mm-hmm. And the entire idea of self-driving cars, there's five different levels of self-driving cars. Everybody thinks the self-driving cars, you just take, you don't touch the steering wheel and it takes you where you want. But there's different levels. You can train a self-driving car, for example, for a specific map, mm-hmm. like around Baylor University. Mm-hmm. So the self-driving cars know the map and they can mm-hmm. go around. But then this idea, I was born in West Virginia. You go to West Virginia, there's these hairpin turns and it's a one-lane highway. And if you meet somebody, you go over to the edge and you almost fall off the edge of the mountain as a coal truck passes you and stuff. I don't know if a self-driving car will ever be able to do that. I have a standing bet with a good friend on whether that will be possible. I don't think it will be. He thinks it will be. And it could indeed be. But nevertheless, think of just all the things that you take for granted right now that are AI related. They're wonderful. They have made our lives better. We just had in our lives a mishap with Amazon. My wife bought something, accidentally put it on my daughter's credit card. My daughter looked at her credit card, said, "I don't know what this is." She cancels her credit card. So all of our Amazon account went down. They shut the whole thing down. I no longer had access to two-day delivery, no longer had access to Amazon Prime. I listened to books on tape. My Audible.com books got taken away. My Alexa didn't work. It was terrible. And it lasted for about a week. And how long did it last? A week and a half? Yeah, we did. We suffered. So we are dependent. We are dependent on these things. If you don't think you're dependent on it, try not using Google for a week. And you can try Bing, but that's like not having any search engine at all. So here are some of the things that we're impacted by. So AI is going to be very, very impactful in our future, and it's going to make our lives a lot easier, and we need to emphasize that. And all of this dystopian sort of stuff that I talked about, all of this hype associated with AI is something that will pass. Because eventually it will come to, it will meet a litmus test and be shown to be wanting. So we're going through a transition now. So again, I'm going to end this with, David, I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. We are fearfully and wonderfully made in terms of the qualities that I mentioned of qualia, creativity, sentience, consciousness. We are above and beyond the computer. We can do non-algorithmic things. And then Psalm 8:6, David also said, "Thou madest man to have dominion over the works of thy hand. Thou hast put all things under his feet." I believe that we are guaranteed now and in the future to also be over the dominion of AI. But like anything, AI is not good or bad. It's like electricity, it's like fire. It's how we use it. And we have this new tool, and it's our job in humanity to use it for good and positive things. And that concludes my talk.
When I think of with this, and maybe this is obvious to everybody, maybe not, but from an apologetic standpoint, if you talk to these atheists long enough, at least the ones that are kind of thought some of these things, if they're emotionally committed to their atheism, they're forced into some form of naturalism, some form of everything is caused by natural forces, right? And so the human mind, the human brain, in the atheist naturalist world, everything is caused. There's no original cause anywhere. The row of dominoes just keeps going down. And so the human brain has to be just a machine. It's a complex machine, it's a wet machine, but it's a machine. And if you can show that a human has any original thought, okay, then you've pulled the linchpin out of their worldview.
Yeah.
And what the terms they end up using is causally closed. The universe is causally closed, and therefore anything that comes out of your mouth or your pen was caused by some prior cause outside of you. And if we can demonstrate that there's some sort of line of thought that was totally unique and creative to a person, then we've basically pulled the linchpin out of the atheist naturalist worldview, right? And the whole house of cards will collapse. Right. That's kind of where this is going.
It is. The irony of that is that anybody that says that is actually stating a self-refuting statement, because what they have do is that they have removed themselves from the restriction of having original thoughts and tried to have an original thought.
Mm-hmm. Wait, how?
When you say, okay, you're totally materialistic, everything you do is predetermined, right? So it's predetermined if you're a materialist that you're going to object to materialism. If they're right and they object to materialism, it's predetermined that they're going to object to materialism. If they object to materialism, that's predetermined. That's part of the way that we're wired. That's part of what we do.
So it's predetermined if I'm a materialist that someone who I'm talking to who is not a materialist is going to say I'm not a materialist. Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. Any other questions?
I think along the same line, Daniel Dennett, the atheist philosopher, and he says that consciousness is an illusion in this respect. He's saying it looks like we make decisions, but the human mind is so complex that we really don't. It's just the mind has emerged from this meat machine, and we don't understand it.
Well, here's a couple of points. Number one is that Christians are many times criticized for appealing to a God of the gaps. Mm-hmm. I'll stand over the spill, it'll go away. Materialists in computer programming are subject to algorithm of the gaps. Mm-hmm. They say, we don't know how to do it, but someday we'll be able to do it. Mm-hmm. It's an algorithm of the gaps.
Yeah, and so this emergent faith statement.
And the emergent faith.
Yeah, that's the mind emerged, that's a faith statement.
It has and by the way, emergence doesn't work. I have done a lot of work in that. It just, out of randomness, if it isn't guided.
But I think that's their faith in AI, that mind will emerge if we get it complex enough to mimic the human brain.
You know what that reminds me of? There's the old story about the optimistic little boy that was put in a room to test him of a big pile of horse manure. And he was in there, and they said, why is this boy so optimistic all the time? And he went in there, and he just got overjoyed, and he started digging in the pile of manure and just throwing it over his head. And they said, why are you so happy? He says, well, with all this manure in here, horse manure in here, there must be a pony inside here somewhere. And that's what I think of when I think of these materialists trying to come up with algorithms. And they say, you know, with all this complexity, there must be some consciousness in there somewhere. It's exactly the same sort of thing, yeah. Since this is being recorded, let's pass around the microphone.
Yeah, it's catching most of you, but especially the ones that are further away, if you could get okay. closer to the mic.
I guess I was just going to ask, is there any, I know you said that you're preparing to do this talk in Austin.
Yeah.
For people who do have that materialist bent in their kind of ontology, are they going to... I know that they can't demonstrate it, but are they going to be resistant to these non-algorithmic qualities that you're listing? Because it does seem to go back to that very foundational element of like, well, that's actually what we're striving for, is to bring about creativity, or they'll redefine qualia in a way that is, because like qualia by definition is subject relevant. So it's first person rather than third person, which is a descriptive type approach. So, but whenever I engage in conversations with these kinds of determinists, it's like you said, like there's this gap argument of, if you bring about this pursuit of it long enough, it just kind of pops up. Like it gets, when complexity continues at that rate, then it just kind of like it emerges or it brought about, kind of like that super intelligence that you brought up. There's a point at which it just kind of stops improving and becomes something other than. So I feel like there's just this resistance that may not be grounded in kind of rational assessment, but rather than if that's my grounding ontology, then I have to reject that those are things that that I can't program or bring about, I suppose. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So arguments about determinism are. Yeah, it's really rough. By the way, the idea, the Turing halting test, this is very interesting. I didn't go into it. There's a generalization of that, which is called Rice's theorem, which says that a computer program, you can't write a computer program to tell what another computer program is going to do on anything. You can't write a meta computer program to say if another computer program will print out the number 3. And what is cool about that is that you have this computer code here. It's totally deterministic. Totally deterministic. But you can't say what it's going to do. So determinism, according to Rice's theorem, does not imply knowability. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit freaky.
Yeah.
Luke?
So I heard a little bit back about these two computers that started communicating in like a more efficient coding language that the programmers didn't write, and so they got all freaked out and turned it off, and I was assuming that was probably pretty easily debunkable, but I just didn't understand exactly what was going on.
That is something that I have not looked into.
Okay.
It sure sounds like me. It sounds like me. It sounds to me like it is pure hyperbole. That something happened in the breakdown between the two computers. They weren't recognizing what was going on. They were still kind of working. So somebody needed a good headline. They needed some good clickbait. They needed some good promotion for their research.
Well, it worked. I got some ad. I looked at the articles.
I know. You looked at the articles. But, consider the source. I think that's another thing you have to do. There's a few things you have to watch out for in AI hype. First of all, are they promising things 10 years or more out? If they do, they're stating stuff for which they will never be accountable. Mm-hmm. Number one, using the terms in the future, this will happen. Anything which is in the future, we have this now, but in the future, we're going to have something which works a lot better. That is to be looked at with a jaundice view. Consider the source. British tabloids like The Sun are not very good sources. Wall Street Journal, pretty reliable. Okay? So consider the source also. And the other thing, if you're really concerned, look into depth. That's what I did on this mind reading thing. I says, wow, this is really cool. And then I looked at the actual paper that they referenced, and they didn't talk about it, but they had to cut a flap out of the guy's skull, and they did this in a ward full of epileptic patients who already had the flap cut out. They were doing treatment of the epilepsy, and so they said, their brains are already exposed. We can apply this work to it. And the result was incredibly limited to about 2 or 3 things, reading your mind for about 2 or 3 things. They had you look at flashcards and things of that sort. But as far as the computers communicating to each other in some unknown language. I haven't looked into that. That's a good idea. I should probably look into that and see what the what actually happened. But it sure sounds like. Okay.
My memory of that was that basically there were a pair of neural networks, and they just programmed them to exchange information between them, and so they produced their own code to exchange that information between them, which of course the researchers couldn't interpret the code, because the neural networks had just figured out some way to represent this information and communicate it back and forth.
Okay.
It doesn't actually sound that interesting to me, but when you frame it in terms of creating a language, I think it's just some representation of data being passed between the two.
And it is an example of use, I believe, probably of seductive semantics.
Yeah.
Creating a new language. So.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading an article yesterday. My friend sent to me. He said, "Look at this," and it says like NASA scientists create life in a lab. And I was literally the first thing I thought of is, which paragraph is it going to be where they say we were able to create like one amino acid? And sure enough, I go down there and it's like, we were able to create this amino acid, but we think that this could have been extrapolated to like create eight amino acids that all came together and formed life. And I was like, okay,
just correct amino acids.
Yeah, it was funny.
Well, see, this is one thing, and you see this in materialistic science all the time. Both in the case of evolution and in AI, there's a little incremental step, and then there's an extrapolation from that little incremental step to some hyperbolic decision. And it's not justified. You can't justify a big generalization from a little itty-bitty incremental step. And we see this happening all the time.
The first time I remember hearing that was Philip Johnson's book, Darwin on Trial. Philip Johnson was a lawyer who was used to building a logical case, and he made that point in his book Darwin on Trial, which is, okay, we made this little incremental step, but is it justified therefore that this huge amount of in this case biology is true? And it's just not.
Oh, I thought you were raising your hand. There's a phenomenon which you probably heard of called the butterfly effect, in which the flapping of the butterfly in one place can cause a war in some other place by a domino sequence of events. Have you heard that term? Okay, the butterfly effect. Indeed, I did a lot, there was a lot of work in my early career of talking about the difference between interpolation and extrapolation. Interpolation is doing things inside the box, it's filling stuff in. Extrapolation is external to the box. It's a fundamental mathematical principle that doing things outside of the box is ill-conditioned or even ill-posed. What does that mean? That means if you sprinkle a little bit of uncertainty on the thing that you're extrapolating, your extrapolations can go whoop, whoop, whoop. It can go all over the place. It is just incredibly sensitive to small perturbations. And so any extrapolation that you hear that isn't justified on terms of where an incremental result will be is not to be believed, I don't believe.
Think Theism is a production of Ross Yocristi at Texas A&M University. Our producers are Ben Hellyer, Andrew Robbins, and Zach Lawson. Ross Yocristi meets every week, and we'd love to meet you too. Please go to thinktheism.org to see our upcoming schedule as well as previous episodes.